Hello, everyone. I'm Katie O'Connor, Director of Policy Development and Programming at the American Constitution Society. Thank you so much for joining us today for the briefing call on Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. I have just a couple of housekeeping items before we get started. First, please note that today's call is being recorded and we'll be providing a link to the recording after the call. Second, we have reserved some time at the end of the call for Q&A, and I'll give additional instructions for asking questions at that time. And finally, we have been approved for 1 hour of California CLE credit for this call. If you'd like to receive credit and haven't done so already, please email Matt Scoble at mscoble@acslaw.org to request the paperwork. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a member of ACS today. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce today's speakers and to congratulate them on this momentous Supreme Court victory. Jesse Hill is the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Judge Ben C. Green Professor of Law at Case Western School of Law. Prior to joining the Case Western faculty in 2003, she practiced First Amendment and Civil Rights Law at Berkman, Gordon, Murray, and Devan in Cleveland. Before entering private practice, she worked at the ACLU Reproductive Freedom Project in New York, litigating challenges to state law restrictions on reproductive rights. And she has also served as a law clerk to the Honorable Karen Nelson Moore of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Rupali Sharma has served as a legal fellow in the U.S. legal program at the Center for Reproductive Rights since 2014. She first worked at the center from 2012 to 2013 as a legal fellow in the Europe program, where she helped develop a case challenging a national abortion ban. Before rejoining the center, Rupali served as a law clerk to the Honorable Matthew F. Kennelly of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. She holds a JD from Yale Law School and a BA in Political Science and Gender Studies from Northwestern University. So thank you both for being here. Rupali, I'm going to ask you to start us off by addressing the opinion in Hellerstedt itself, both the legal standard that the court used and the short-term and long-term impact that the decision will have on women and families.
Sure. One, thank you so much for having me. So I think yesterday was just a momentous day, not only for women, but really anyone who thinks that a fundamental right has to exist not only in theory, but in fact. So what the court did is that it struck down both of the requirements we had challenged, both the admitting privileges requirement statewide and the ASC requirements statewide. But what it also did was that it clarified the undue burden standard articulated in the 1992 Casey decision, namely that courts have an independent duty to scrutinize evidence to ensure that any given restriction, the burdens it imposes on abortion access don't outweigh the benefits it provides. So to illustrate, with the admitting privileges requirement, for example, the opinion has a lot of examples, but one that comes to mind is that at oral argument, the Texas Solicitor General was asked if there was even one instance in which a single woman would experience a better health outcome due to the requirement. And the Texas Solicitor General not only was able to name none, but conceded that there was nothing in the record evidence suggesting that, you would see that better requirement. Similarly, with the ASC requirement, the court credited the district court's opinion, which had found that the ASC requirements are so tangential to patient safety in the context of abortion that they're nearly arbitrary. So on the one hand, the court reaffirmed that neither of the requirements provide any medical benefit. then on the other side, the court looked at the burdens that each of the requirement imposes on abortion access, namely extremely long distances to facilities and extremely long waiting times. The restrictions taken together would have shuttered over 75% of the abortion facilities in Texas for 5.4 million women of reproductive age. Really, we would have been left with about 9 clinics for that many women. And so those taken together, the court found that both of the requirements were clearly an undue burden. And so practically speaking, what that means, aside from giving us a clarification of the standard and something we can use to challenge other requirements that don't serve any valid purpose, what the court's decision allows us to do is, one, ensure that the clinics that are open today stay open, two, potentially reopen some of the clinics that closed, and then allow new clinics to come in as well. That said, I do want to emphasize that, you know, we lost clinics that we will never get back in Texas, right? I mean, these were clinics that were serving their communities since Roe, some of them, and we'll never get them back because of these sham laws, the laws that the court found unconstitutional. And so it's important, you know, that we not only rely on courts, but we really push state legislatures and Congress to also protect the right to safe and legal abortion. And then, as I touched on earlier, given the clarification of the standard, you know, there are hundreds of medically unnecessary laws throughout the country. So this standard allows us to look at those laws and potentially challenge them as well, too. I mean, the decision is really sweeping, and it'll have a very broad impact.
Thank you. So Jesse, I'm wondering if you can put this decision in the larger context, how it fits into abortion jurisprudence more broadly, and what impact, if any, it might have on future abortion jurisprudence and potentially other areas of the law.
Sure. I mean, I agree with Rupali and want to echo what she said, that it really clarifies the undue burden standard in a very important way by telling states that when they pass these so-called health and safety measures, that they are not going to pass constitutional muster if the burdens on abortion access outweigh the, you know, health benefits or safety benefits of the law. And I just want to say, you know, what a smart strategy this was, too, to litigate the case in this way, because to focus on the lack of health benefits as part of the undue burden analysis, that you have to say, well, what's the benefit you're getting in return for this burden? You know, if the burdens outweigh the benefits, then the burden is undue. It's in the sense of unwarranted. And I think that's really valuable, because it makes some sense of this standard that everyone has been struggling with really since Casey was decided. Casey seemed to present, a lot of courts took Casey as presenting the undue burden standard as being this kind of numbers game where you're trying to figure out what's a large fraction of women, well, what's the denominator of the fraction, what's the numerator of the fraction that are being burdened by this law. And it would lead to decisions that could potentially vary state to state depending on the, you know, sort of demographics and geography and things like that. I think, you know, to kind of cut through all that and to say, look, it's just by definition undue if it imposes a huge burden without any meaningful benefit. That was a really smart way to go about clarifying the undue burden standard. It gives a tool moving forward to challenge other pretextual laws, and it really makes the undue burden standard mean something. So I think that's a really important thing. It's going to put pressure on legislatures in the future if they think they're going to continue to pass sort of so-called health and safety measures. And it's going to sort of make it much harder for those to pass constitutional muster. Also, to kind of put it into another way of thinking about the sort of broader context of this case, part of the reason why we saw a sort of rash of these sort of pretextual health and safety measures in state legislatures over the past, you know, maybe decade and a half in particular, is that anti-abortion forces had kind of turned to this women's health rationale as a sort of rhetorical strategy, because they realized that trying to save the fetus and talking about the value of, you know, the unborn child and how the fetus is more valuable than the woman essentially was not getting them anywhere. And that people were just not finding that that kind of language to really resonate with them by and large. And so they really found a successful strategy when they shifted to saying, no, we're just trying to protect women. And in the meantime, we just happen to be driving abortion clinics out of business. So I think now the Supreme Court has given the message to states that, you know, health and safety and medicine are not just whatever you say it is, whatever you say they are, certainly not in this context where there is a fundamental constitutionally protected right that's being infringed upon by these laws. So I think those are a couple of important takeaways. I think there may be other sorts of laws that could be at risk under this, other sort of pretextual health regulations. We could think about maybe ultrasound laws, telemedicine bans for medication abortion, other kinds of laws that are like admitting privileges. Like some states have requirements that for written transfer agreements with a hospital, things like that. So I think those are question marks, but those are things that could be at risk moving forward. One last point I'll just make, because you kind of asked about doctrine more generally. You know, it's interesting that Kennedy didn't end up writing. Not only did he not write the majority opinion, but he didn't write at all. I think the opinion ended up, you know, more analytical in that way because he didn't, maybe. Some of us saw a sort of connection to broader themes in the same-sex marriage cases and the sort of question of dignity more generally in connection with substantive due process. And, you know, that connection was really not was not made here at all. I think it sort of, in some ways, leaves abortion as a sort of sui generis doctrinal area, if you will. So to me, it was maybe a missed opportunity to see the bigger picture here, but I'm pretty happy overall with how the case turned out.
Right. So Rupali, some of the coverage that we've seen in the past 24 hours has argued that this decision actually expands the undue burden standard beyond what Casey envisioned. Do you agree with that, or do you think it just clarified what undue burden means?
Thank you for that question. So I wanted to begin just by disagreeing slightly with what was said earlier. I mean, I agree that we don't have sort of the sweeping language we've seen in some Kennedy opinions, but I do think that this decision makes clear that the abortion right is a right that's held by women, including the most vulnerable women, right? So it might be written in a more legal manner, but the idea that you can't impinge on a constitutional right, including access to abortion, without hard evidence that a court could assess, really protects the most vulnerable. So even though we don't have that language, to me, it really got us a step closer to restoring the dignity of many women who I think these sort of laws hurt the most. But to answer your question, no, I mean, I think that Casey was clear and that the standard that was articulated in the Whole Woman's Health decision is a standard that we've always had. And I think Breyer also made that very clear in the opinion. I think the very first paragraph of the opinion quotes Casey and talks about how unnecessary health regulations that have the purpose or effect of imposing a substantial obstacle, which is, you know, where the weighing standard comes from, you know, he quotes Casey. That was always in Casey. I think the problem is that state legislatures have been sneaking around that for so long that we had forgotten that a little bit. And so to me, it's definitely an affirming of a standard we've always had. And now I'm glad that the message is sent to other courts and certainly to legislatures. And we're seeing the signs of that even now. I mean, today the Alabama AG said that it would no longer be appealing the admitting privileges decision in that state. So, you know, I think the court spoke, and it spoke loud and clear and very much anchored the decision in Casey.
So you mentioned the admitting privileges case in Alabama, and the court this morning, or yesterday morning, denied cert in that case and in the Wisconsin case, and it seems to me that that might be sort of the death knell for admitting privileges provisions at the least. Do you get that sense?
Yeah, just to clarify, so the court declined to take our Mississippi case, which also involves a virtually identical limiting privileges requirement, and then also declined to take the Wisconsin case, and you're correct, that also involves an admitting privileges requirement. And I think it's correct to say that admitting privileges requirements, regardless of which state, are presumptively unconstitutional. They tend to be, you know, pretty much the same requirement from state to state, and this decision lays out line by line why that requirement doesn't promote health in the least, but has very severe burdens on women. So I think it's correct to say that, you know, it's essentially dead. I will say, though, that, again, this decision to me is sweeping. It's not limited to admitting privileges and ASC requirements or even trap laws. I think that it's a powerful tool that we can use to challenge restrictions that essentially don't serve the asserted purpose, right? Whatever interest the state is asserting. If the state cannot provide evidence to that effect and the burdens it imposes on women outweigh the benefit, then the law should fall. So I think it's broader than just admitting privileges or even ASC requirements.
Right. Jesse, so the dissents and some commentators have argued that abortion is getting special treatment. Does this surprise you? In the past, scholars have argued that abortion exceptionalism has actually meant that abortion has less court protection. So what do you make of this new argument?
Yeah, right. I guess it's not really a new argument. It's actually a drum that Justice Scalia had been beating for quite some time. And I really heard, actually especially Thomas's brief dissent, but also Alito's dissent, just sort of channeling that language to a huge extent. So it's been a criticism, exactly, that has come from both sides. And I think, you know, I think there is some merit to it. I think that I think there's some truth to the fact that abortion is treated differently, I guess, is what I mean. So it is treated as unique, sort of singled out for unique burdens within constitutional law. It's sort of spoken about differently. The court, like I just mentioned earlier, didn't sort of connect it up, had an opportunity to, and didn't at least explicitly connect it up to its broader substantive due process doctrine and so on. So I think it's disingenuous to suggest that abortion has been singled out for specially favored treatment when really it has been singled out in a lot of ways and mostly resulting in, you know, until now, arguably, you know, very lax oversight of state restrictions on abortion by the courts in the name of the undue burden standard, for example. It's gotten the kind of review that in the past has sometimes approached rational basis review, which no other constitutional right gets. So, I think if anything, it's kind of gone in the other direction. And certainly, at least here, the court has shown that the abortion is being taken as seriously as a constitutional right as other constitutional rights, you know, even if it didn't, like I said, connect it up more globally to the broader substantive due process concerns.
Right. And this is another question for you, Jesse. This case was about two provisions that were premised on the health and safety of a woman seeking an abortion. What do you think is the impact of this case on abortion restrictions that are premised on some other purpose?
Well, so, I mean, I guess the main purposes that we have seen so far, and maybe I'm not thinking of others, but, you know, there tend to be two kinds of lines of reasoning behind these sorts of abortion restrictions. The one has to do with purported health and safety benefits and sort of women protective rationales. And then the other line has been fetal protection or protecting the state's interest in fetal life or in potential life, which, you know, Casey sort of stepped around and said, well, states can, you know, express an interest in fetal life or in potential life as long as they don't actually impose an undue burden. So I'm not sure, you know, that this framework in Whole Woman's Health is going to have a lot to say directly to laws that are passed in the interest of protecting, you know, where the state blatantly says it's trying to protect potential life or fetal life. But the whole other slew of sort of, you know, we're just trying to protect women, their health, their safety, their mental health, all of those things that are often supported by absolute junk science, if any science at all, are definitely at risk after this opinion.
Rupali, I have sort of two joint questions. I was planning on asking you why ACS members should care about this decision, but I think another piece of that is, you know, how do we stay ahead of these anti-abortion laws? It seems like they're being passed more quickly than we can challenge them, and you mentioned in one of your earlier answers that you think that the legislature should take note of this opinion and take it upon themselves the responsibility not to be passing unconstitutional laws. Do you think that's going to happen? Do you think there are other things that that the pro-choice community should be doing? And how can ACS members be a part of that?
Sure. I mean, so as to why we should care, I actually think that all of us have sort of touched on that as we've been talking. But I think one thing that stands out to me is that this decision in many ways isn't only about abortion access. I mean, it's certainly, to go back to your earlier discussion about whether abortion is treated differently, it's almost like when something is not accorded the respect it deserves for so long, treating it equally makes it seem like you're treating it, you know, like specially. And so I think that's what Thomas's dissent sort of meant. But anyways, like in terms of why we should care, I mean, I think that if you can take someone's fundamental rights away, and a fundamental right that's so important as to, you know, affect your body and your mental health, your physical health, your family, your future, and take it away without a damn good reason, I mean, I think we should all be concerned, right? I mean, that wouldn't be limited to abortion. You could begin to apply that in other areas of the law. So I think it's very, very important that the court, you know, again, had already drawn that line in Casey and then underscored it, I think, in yesterday's opinion. So I think to the extent that we all care about fundamental rights and the Constitution meaning anything, the fact that you have to demonstrate a valid state reason for impinging on abortion access should be important to us all. In terms of how we can stay ahead, I totally understand your frustration. We certainly have been dealing with this for years. You know, it feels like a game of whack-a-mole where it's one restriction after the next. And the real heroes in this are providers and the women who are so resilient and you know, many of them fortunately managed to get care at the end of the day because of their resilience and not because states are helping them, know this the best. But I think one thing to consider is that the courts, while extremely helpful, and certainly it's their duty to step in when fundamental rights are being violated, as they did in Texas, are not the only solution. So I think I touched on this earlier. All the branches of the government have a duty to uphold the Constitution in their own way. And certainly state legislatures can be doing more, not only not passing pretextual laws that hurt women, but also protecting our rights, passing laws that promote access to safe and legal and affordable abortion. The same goes for Congress. So I think we should think as broadly as possible and call on all aspects of the government to protect these rights.
So I think, operator, we're going to go ahead and open it up for questions. And while we're waiting for questions to get into the queue, I have one other.
If anyone would like to ask a question, please hit star 1 on your telephone keypad, star 1, and I'll access your line.
So the question that I have for both of you is just, what were the most surprising things about the majority opinion and about the dissents in your opinion? And I'll throw it to Jesse first.
Okay, I was going to say, you know, I was, for one thing, I was surprised that it was as sweeping and broad as it was. I was very pleased, but I really, you know, I think it could have gone either way. With the need to keep Justice Kennedy in the majority, it could have ended up being a narrower opinion. I will also say that something that surprised me about the majority that Rupali touched on is that the majority actually specifically talked about the burdens on poor women. And also poor and rural women, which are words that you just rarely sort of see in print coming from the Supreme Court. And that they also did express concern about travel and delay, which are issues that are just fundamental, I think, to the undue burden calculation on the ground, but often courts have not been taking as seriously as they should. So those are things that I was surprised and pleased to see in the opinion. As far as the dissents, I don't think there was as much surprising there. I think I probably could have guessed that what they were going to say going in. So, yeah, I'll think about it if I come up with anything.
Okay. And Rupali?
Sure. So I'm not going to lie. I'm surprised that we got a Breyer opinion and not a Kennedy opinion, I have to say. And I think we touched on how that might have made a difference a little bit. But in terms, I would like to just comment on the dissents. I do think it's telling the Alito dissent, which was long and which was very thorough, mainly touched on procedural issues, right? I obviously think he got it wrong, but really relied on sort of the procedural technical issues versus questioning the right or questioning sort of the crisis situation in Texas. It really sort of, I think his most substantive point was whether we had enough evidence, which Breyer's opinion thoroughly demonstrated that we did, and the district court opinion already had. So to me, I mean, it's not surprising. It's always nice to see that that's the strongest that they had on their side, right? I mean, it didn't go to the core of our argument, and that to me was gratifying.
Operator, do we have any questions in the queue?
We do have a question. Our first question is from Sarah Boonen. Your line is live.
Yes, hi. I teach over at Suffolk Law School. My question is about, they open the opinion, obviously, as you mentioned, by talking about Casey and the standard. And, the standard is the purpose or effect is to place a substantial obstacle. And obviously the opinion focused, and I think the lower court record focused on the effect. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the purpose prong and either why it didn't play much of a role in the lower court proceedings here or where you see the purpose prong kind of playing out in the future, because a lot of these, state legislators aren't very shy about saying, we'll stop abortion in our state, and so on and so forth. So if you could just talk about the purpose prong.
Sure, I can start. I don't think that decision addressed purpose head on. That said, it didn't find that there wasn't an improper purpose. I think it just didn't address it. And to me, what's important as a litigator is that this decision does allow us to challenge pretextual laws, right? So if you are enacting an abortion restriction for the purpose of shutting down abortion access or to punish women for exercising a constitutional right, this decision should be able to strike down that law. We should be able to strike down that law using this decision. And so to me, it gets at pretext, even if it didn't squarely address it. I also think that the improper purpose prong of Casey remains good law. Again, they just didn't address it. So it might be something that comes up in one of our later cases, but I think it remains good law. It's very clear in Casey, and this decision still lets us get at pretextual abortion restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think all of that sounds right to me, too, but I think just add that purpose prong challenges are extremely hard to win. I think they almost never win, even when you have a lot of evidence. And so, again, this kind of demonstrates what was so smart about focusing the challenge in this way, because it allows you to get at that pretext without having to get a court to say, legislatures were acting improperly with an improper purpose and, doing the wrong thing here.
Yep. Thank you.
Just a reminder, if anyone would like to ask a question, please hit star 1 on your telephone keypad, star 1, and I'll access your line. There are no further questions in queue, but just a reminder, you can hit star 1 if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment.
So I do have some other questions for you while we wait for others from callers. one of the questions that I got by email from someone who was planning on calling in, and Jesse, you mentioned this earlier, but I'm wondering if you can go into a little bit more detail about how the amicus briefs and this decision specifically address the burden on women of color and poor women in Texas.
So, thanks. I worked on an amicus brief with Melissa Murray and Glenn Cohen that was really focused on the sort of dignitary injuries when the state acts in this way, essentially sends women out of state, makes them travel hundreds of miles, exposes them to, you know, health risks and other risks in order to just obtain a safe and legal abortion. And, you know, there were a lot of amicus briefs in front of the court, of course, in this case, right? And it seems like the one that they paid the most attention to maybe was the ACOG brief, they focused very much on the scientific and medical evidence here. I think it's right that it's a point that shouldn't be lost. And Rupali made the point too, that, you know, although the court didn't specifically speak in terms of dignity, and that's kind of Justice Kennedy's thing, this is a sort of certainly a victory for women's dignity, and that, you know, women in the big cities and women with money in any state in the country are always going to have access to abortion. You know, it's a lot of times exactly the point of these fights is over women who are not so well situated, who are rural women or poor women, who are the ones who are most threatened when services get reduced. Just like, by the way, in Texas happened when Texas, you know, defunded Planned Parenthood services, women's health services in the state as well, wouldn't let them participate in their women's health program. It's always sort of the poor women, the already disadvantaged women that are going to be impacted.
Right. Rupali, I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but and if so, please go ahead. But another question that I had for you is, can you talk about the role of amicus briefs in this decision more broadly? Were you surprised that that the court didn't focus on stories briefs as they had in the Gonzalez decision?
Sure. Yeah. So just sort of carrying that thought forward, I think it's correct that the court relied heavily on the ACOG and AMA brief. I think that, and we've been discussing this the entire time, this decision really is about the importance of evidence and the duty that courts have to look at evidence. And I think that the majority opinion was meticulous about that, looking at expert testimony, looking at the amicus briefs, looking at depositions, looking at stipulations. I mean, very, very strong on that. And I think that also the opinion relied heavily on amicus briefs in general. So certainly the scientific briefs, but also the legal briefs. I think the majority opinion cited a total of 9 amicus briefs. Justice Ginsburg's concurrence, which was fairly short, I believe cited at least 4 amicus briefs. I think they relied heavily on it, and I think that was a good thing. In terms of the stories, not explicitly citing them, to me, I mean, the heft of the court's opinion and the clarification of the standard even alone, given who it benefits, it's clear that those are the sort of women that the court had in mind. And again, to me, that's maybe one of the most beautiful parts of the entire opinion.
Just checking, do we have any questions in the queue?
There are no further questions at this time, but just a reminder, if anyone would like to ask a question or make a comment, please hit *1 on your telephone keypad, *1, and I'll access your line.
So I think we've... I think you both sort of touched a little bit on this, and so I apologize if I'm making you repeat yourself, but I thought I'd ask it directly. Abortion jurisprudence has been the basis for analysis in other contexts like LGBT rights, the Second Amendment, et cetera. It seems like this case, just given the kind of restrictions, the reasons given for those restrictions, it might not have much of an impact. But do you see it having any influence on rights in those contexts.
Any influence on other rights?
Right. LGBT rights, Second Amendment, et cetera.
Well, this, I guess I'll jump in and sort of speculate, and that's all this really is pure speculation. But, you know, I mean, it's given the boldness of the majority in this case, and a lot of people are speculating now, why did, you know, Justice Kennedy go along? He didn't write. He didn't write separately. He went along with a very sweeping, a very liberal, solidly liberal opinion. You know, is he starting to move more solidly in that camp as well? Is this just a bolder court now that's not afraid to sort of take back some of these rights? I mean, I think we can hope that. I think that at this point it's too soon to say, but I would like to see it as a sign that, you know, that the liberal wing of the court is emboldened and may, you know, if all goes well, continue to be emboldened.
Yeah, I agree. I'll just add that there, you know, in some ways there's a direct line from Casey to Lawrence to Burgessall, so I would certainly expect this decision to have ramifications even in other areas of the law. I would say, and I think I had mentioned this at the beginning, to me also what this case was about was access on the ground, right? So a right being not just in theory and in beautiful language, but in fact in actual people's lives, regardless of their zip code or their race or their income level. And so I wonder if decisions in these other areas of law, which also, you know, restrictions usually have the greatest impact on the most vulnerable people, if the court will begin doing an even better job of privileging actual people's stories and their experiences and working from there instead of the other way around, right, like the highfalutin language to the personal experience, which, you know, I think we can all be excited about.
So it sounds like you we're actually happy with the lack of highfalutin language. I'm wondering if there was any disappointment in the tone of the opinion, that there weren't any legal flourishes.
I mean, I can start. To me, you know, this is law, and what these cases are about is that there are people suffering on the ground because of these restrictions. And this case lets us continue to dismantle the laws that are the cause of their suffering. So, you know, that to me is poetic enough. Like, I don't need the other language. I think it's an incredibly strong opinion, joking aside, because of how legally strong it is and how moored it is in precedent and in law. So, you know, to me, to that extent, the tone and the language very much matches the integrity of the opinion, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, it doesn't take sort of highfalutin language to kind of, you know, bring me to tears over the fact that, you know, this victory and how wonderful it is. I just think, you know, it would have been lovely if Justice Breyer had seen fit to put in some language about how important and fundamental the right is and all of that. But in the end, I mean, that's not what's winning the next case. It's just not. And you know, Obergefell was a wonderful victory as well, but everybody is scratching their heads trying to figure out what do we do with this? You know, what does it really mean for the future? So I think, you know, in the end, everybody's kind of better off with this very careful, very analytical, focused opinion that we got.
So I have gotten a couple of questions by email. I'm just wondering if there are any on the line right now.
There are no questions in queue.
Okay. So one of the questions that I just got by email, do you expect after this decision for the anti-choice movement to move away from the health and safety of the mother rationale?
I mean, I can start, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it's not in their interest to continue passing these laws because this decision is very clear that those laws won't stand unless they can demonstrate that they're actually serving that purpose, and they can't, right? So it's not just the Supreme Court opinion. I mean, if you look at the district court opinions in these other cases that were making their way up the pipeline until this morning, the district courts were just as meticulous as the district court in the Texas decision was as to finding, you know, how badly of a job these restrictions do in promoting women's health, and in fact they do the opposite. So I think it would not be in their interest to keep going this direction. So for that reason, I could see them pivoting. But, you know, I think we need to continue analyzing this opinion and, again, the other cases that are working their way up, and we might have a better sense of which direction they'll be going in.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I mean, I think there's one of two possibilities. So either they abandon this sort of line of attack and move toward others, and I don't know exactly what that would be. I mean, I would say there have also been a spate of laws around banning abortion for particular reasons like sex selection or fetal anomaly and things like that. And those, you know, those seem to be an attempt to sort of co-opt other kinds of equality claims or dignity claims that and use them to ban abortion. So maybe that's one line that we'll see more of. I'm not sure. That would kind of remove itself from the health and safety rationale. I guess the second possibility is that they keep trying to pass these laws and just try to manufacture scientific or medical evidence to support them. I wouldn't be totally surprised if that happens to some extent, and they try to get courts to sort of accept that kind of false science. But, you know, again, it's going to be a much harder, much more of an uphill battle to make that happen.
So I did get one other email question, and I think this is actually a good one. Well, it's probably a useful one to end on, if nothing else. So Rupali, especially, I think you could maybe just lay out the landscape moving forward. What actions, upcoming challenges do you see immediately and in the next couple of years in the abortion jurisprudence?
Sure. I mean, so I think it's important to remember that nothing happens overnight, although the court did act pretty swiftly this morning. But, you know, what I'll say is I think the first thing that this impacts just directly, obviously, it was the cases that were in front of the court that the court declined to grant because it spoke very clearly in the case. Then it's probably admitting privileges requirements and also ASC requirements that fall into the bucket of being onerous without providing any benefits. But that said, I don't think we're limited to those two types of laws, nor do I think we're limited to trap laws in general. I do think, you know, we just got the opinion yesterday. I think we need to study it. I think we need to study the legislation in other states before we have a concrete idea of where the next challenges are. I will say that consistent with the opinion and consistent with our work overall, we would like to keep challenging the sort of restrictions that have the greatest impact on women and their families, and particularly the people that are the most heard but have often gone unheard, right, and have gone not noticed. And so I think that the sort of laws that really target poor women and women of color is a good place to start looking to see how we could apply this landmark opinion.
If I could, Katie, can I jump in
yes,
with a
absolutely.
Sort of comment slash question? And I'd be interested to hear Rupali's reaction because, I mean, it does seem like, having, you know, read and digested but not fully dissected this opinion, that, you know, the admitting privileges holding was much more, you know, it was much cleaner, less sort of fact-intensive, and you kind of alluded to this just now, Rupali, than the ASC requirement, which did, you know, sort of depend on a finding that these regulations were particularly onerous. Of course, you know, an ASC requirement is different from an admitting privileges requirement in that, like, it can look very different in different states. It's not one requirement. It tends to be a slew of regulations. So it's really a situation where the devil is in the details, right? So I wonder whether, I guess, whether that's a cause of concern moving forward or whether there's any danger that courts will sort of use that, courts who are hostile maybe to abortion rights, use that as an opportunity to sort of exploit an ambiguity in the opinion or to sort of exploit facts that are, it's just sort of not find the right where the facts might be slightly less favorable than they were in Texas or something like that.
Yeah, I'll just chime in. So I think you hit the nail on the head in the sense of ASU requirements just are different from state to state. And, you know, Texas's certainly was the most draconian in many respects. It didn't allow waivers. It didn't allow grandfathering. But to me, the key question, and I think the opinion supports this, is not, you know, it's not whether it's an ASU requirement technically or not, but really, like, you begin with the burdens on women and you begin with the asserted interest, right? What, why is the state in, continuing to enforce the restriction if it's harming women and leading to delays and leading to longer travel distances and also other burdens that maybe were encapsulated in the Texas decision, but, you know, states are different too, and so burdens look different in different places, and I think there's room in the decision.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you're right in that it's not as clean, but to me, because the decision was not about trap laws or ASU requirements or admitting privileges, but really about evidence and the weighing standard, the undue burden standard, I don't think it would be in the interest of the anti-choice movement to keep harping on this. I'm sure that they'll find something else, but... I think that it shouldn't be difficult to strike down an ASC law if it truly burdens women, which, you know, we would be able to demonstrate.
That sounds great. Well, I guess I'll ask one more time if there are any questions.
We do have a question, and it's from Melvina Nathanson. Your line is live.
Oh, hello. Yeah, I thought that you were doing that last, and I almost forgot. Oh, here's my question. I've read some stuff about abortion, anti-abortion activists talking about fetal pain. Does that have any traction as a fetal pain as a justification for regulations?
Yeah, I can start with that. I mean, again, so this isn't talking about any particular requirement or any particular litigation, but if what I think you have in mind is maybe sort of ban or some restriction that's grounded on this notion that fetal pain. And again, I think then we're in the realm of science and the state would have the same onus to show that the restriction serves some benefit, right? And if women are not able to get a procedure, or I would say, you know, not only just stop from getting an abortion, but humiliated in the process or degraded in the process or suffer the sort of harms that Casey was meant to protect against, right? The abortion right exists because of dignity, because of liberty, because of equality. I would think that that law would fall under the standard articulated in Whole Woman's Health. But, you know, hypothetically speaking, of course, it would depend on the path.
Yeah, I think I agree. And I mean, as far as the last time I've looked at the issue, I think there's a fair amount of agreement that the studies that were sort of relied on by legislatures who did point to this fetal pain idea, a lot of them were trying to say that it was around 20 weeks or 20 to 24 weeks maybe that there would be fetal pain and all of this, and that most of that is simply not good evidence at all. It's not scientific. It's been refuted. I mean, that's, again, you know, to ask the specific sort of question, my understanding is that it's not based on good evidence. But it is an area where there's been sort of some waving around of studies that were later not found to be so reliable, but, you know, where there's been an attempt to sort of produce evidence on the other side that would allow legislatures to act. I think Rapali's right, but in the end, it's not going to be, they're not going to hold up either, but it is an area where there's sort of some evidence out there.
Right, and right, it's junk science, and so, you know, in this decision as well, Texas certainly made the attempt to make it seem like it had credible experts and was offering testimony on par with the sort of testimony our experts were offering, but the district court was very much able to see through that, as have district courts in Alabama and Wisconsin, and so I'm confident that courts would be able to see through this as well.
Well, I would, I think we... we'll be wrapping up. I want to give you guys an opportunity if you have any last thoughts. If you don't, that's okay too.
I mean, I'll just add that I think this is a really exciting moment. I mean, we won, so we can celebrate that, but I think also because it gives us momentum, right? So we have been fighting this battle for a long time. It's the first step. We know there's a lot of work ahead, but we got really powerful confirmation from the court that it hears us. And so I think we should ride that and not be deterred from, you know, challenging whatever restrictions the other side can come up with, and also moving closer to taking more affirmative action, whether it's in court or, again, in the other branches of government.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's just such a great feeling. It's such a huge victory. I think it's wonderful. I think we should not take our foot off the pedal, though, and you know, we need to recognize that certainly we don't know where exactly things go from here, but there's the other side. The anti-choice folks are not giving up anytime soon. There's always going to be a new challenge, and really, you know, we'll have to see what the lower courts do. I mean, the Supreme Court certainly did a wonderful thing and gave a great basis moving forward. But, you know, time will tell where we are in the future with abortion rights.
Good. Well, I want to thank Rupali and Jesse so much. And I want to thank the many, many organizations and individuals that made this victory possible. Thanks to all of our participants, too, for joining us on today's call. And I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect your line.